I'm David Wessel, director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution, and I'm very pleased to be joined by a number of colleagues this morning to talk about the CPI report, the inflation report. Wendy Edelberg is director of the Hamilton Project at Brookings. Justin Wolfers will be joining us shortly as a professor at the University of Michigan. And after we talk about the big picture, we're going to turn to our friends at the Bipartisan Policy Center, Zan Fisher, who's going to talk about energy, and Dennis Shea, who specializes in housing, both of which are pretty significant parts of the consumer price index. So the news today was a bit alarming if you look at the headlines. The consumer prices in June rose 1.3% from the month before. And even if you take out food and energy prices, which are very volatile, the so-called core CPI rose 0.7% between June and May. If you look over the past 12 months, the numbers are also pretty alarming. The increase was 9.1% for the headline CPI, which was faster than any 12 months we've seen since November 1981. And the core, that is prices minus food and energy, were up 5.9%. So by any measure, this is a lot of inflation. And already we've seen in the financial markets, there's now putting a 30% chance on the possibility that the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates a full percentage point at its next meeting. So Wendy, let me start with you. When you just look at the numbers this morning, what strikes you, and do you think this is as bad as it's going to get, or do you think there's some reason to believe that this will continue?
So, hi, David. I found the numbers also pretty alarming, but not just because of all of the headline numbers that you were ticking off, but actually some of the detail worried me more. So there were lots of places where I expected to see big numbers. I expected to see big numbers in energy. I expected to see big numbers in shelter. But I was hoping to see softer numbers and possibly, you know, even in my wildest dreams, outright declines in core goods. So, and we didn't. We actually saw higher inflation for core goods in June than we saw in May. And one of the reasons that worries me so much is that we are actually seeing softer demand and higher inventories for a lot of different goods in these categories. And if, you know, our models were working the way we hope they do, if we had reason to hope that everything was going to be copacetic going forward, it would mean that the weaker demand resulted in lower inflation, and it looks like it hasn't.
Thanks. I did take some comfort from the fact that hotel and motel rates and airfares were down. So that was about the only silver lining I could find in here. Justin, I've seen some early commentary that from people saying, yes, but since the government measured the prices for June, we've seen some decline in energy prices, and it's led some people to say it might not be so bad going forward. Do you share Wendy's concern about the non-energy and food stuff, or do you see something here that's encouraging?
I think there's two perspectives which are both correct. One is this was a no good, very bad, horrible inflation report. The other is if you look forward, if you think about what are the key drivers of inflation, one of them is obviously businesses' costs. What are their key costs? Labor. And labor costs are rising at barely a little bit above 4%. And if there's any productivity growth at all, that would suggest that businesses' costs are growing at something like 2 to 3%, which would suggest that in due course, inflation's going to fall. The other really important input cost for businesses is energy. And the important point is not that energy prices have fallen a little bit, though they have. But if they just stay where they are, then they'll stop contributing to further future inflation. So that's enough to move energy from a big positive contributor to inflation to taking it completely off the table. So the looking forward, the fundamentals still seem to suggest, I hate to use this word again, but inflation is transitory. The only thing that we've learned is during a pandemic, the word transitory means twice as long as we used to think transitory meant.
One implication of what you said about the relationship between wages and prices is that the purchasing power for the typical American family is really getting squeezed here, that even though many people are getting raises, the raises aren't nearly enough to compensate for the increase in prices. And that seems to me to account for a lot of the anxiety one hears from the public and sees in the surveys. Do you agree?
I think absolutely. Look, the reality is that in 5 years' time, wages will have fully accounted for all of what's happened to prices. That might seem like a crazy sort of a forecast, but it's more than that. It's a promise. Because in every country around the world, in every historical episode, whenever prices rise, wages tend to follow. What we're in at the moment is that awkward moment when prices have risen, but wages haven't yet caught up. And I think it's slightly worse than that, which is many of us this year will get a slightly larger wage rise than we have recently. Maybe you'll get 4% wage rise. But people tend to think, well, that 4% wage rise is because I was a terrific worker, rather than thinking, well, actually, that was just to help make up for what happened to inflation. And so we always feel like inflation is stealing from us, even if the reality is that over the medium run, wages tend to keep up with prices. Hmm.
So, Wendy, what do you think accounts for the fact that we're seeing so much inflation, even beyond the food and energy sector, which we know is partly driven by what's happened in Ukraine?
Well, the bad news version of the answer to that question is that that expectations about inflation in the near term have risen, and even holding constant what's happening to demand, holding constant what's happening to input prices, firms are raising their prices simply because they expect that everybody else is going to raise their prices. And once inflation expectations rise like that and really get entrenched in people's behavior, it's very difficult to change that dynamic. And that's the very much the bad news story, where we worry about, let's say, the Fed having to take more dramatic action to slow the economy and bring inflation down in order to change those expectations. So that's the bad news version. The good news version is that this is, things take time to work their way into prices. It's true that commodity prices were down in the last couple of months. And, it may just be that commodity prices take a little time to really make their way into final goods. And so what we're just seeing is lags from the rise in commodity prices, earlier in the year. And, same with inventory to sales ratios are up, but it's just going to take a little time for those to work their way into prices. And so we just need to sit tight, and we really will see prices come down as what we think the normal factors that should drive inflation down really take hold.
So, Justin, Wendy mentioned inflation expectations, which seems to be the third sentence of every speech by a Federal Reserve official. And the idea makes sense that if people begin to believe that we're going to have 8-9% inflation, that they'll begin to plan accordingly. Businesses will raise prices, landlords will raise rents, workers will at least try to get raises of that ilk, and so forth. But even though these inflation numbers are, the headlines are kind of scary, as I read the inflation expectation measures, as vague and flaky as they are, it looks like both consumers and financial markets think that the Fed can somehow bring this under control without us having a permanent or a long-lasting inflation problem. Does that make sense to you?
I think it does. Maybe we should also just give people some credit for some economic literacy. Look, the headline number is 9.1%, but a third of that is energy prices. We know directly the cause of those energy prices, and we know that they're not persistent and so not going to stick with us. So this is the reason that economists focus on so-called core measures of inflation. But the point is that the underlying rate of actual price increases in most parts of the economy is nowhere near numbers like 9%. The question, and so it's much less frightening Now, if inflation expectations were at 6%, that would still be terrifying to the Fed, but it wouldn't be these headline and angst-causing numbers we're going to see on the front page of tomorrow's newspaper. So the underlying rate of price rises in most parts of the economy is nowhere near 9.1%. That's not stating that the numbers are inaccurate. But instead, most prices are rising at 4 to 5%, and some of that still reflects, remember, we're not that far from the pandemic. And so when the economy gets back to normal, things are going to look a lot more, well, normal.
Yeah, that reminds me of that great Keynes line that economists do us little good when they tell us that when the storm is past, the sea will be calm again. But I take your point. Let me turn to Zan Fishman for a minute. Zan, energy prices in the CPI rose 7.5% in just 1 month alone, and they're up nearly 42% over the past 12 months. So, two questions. One, what in brief is driving energy prices up so much? And two, oil prices have come down a little in the last few days. Do you think that things are going to get better?
Yeah, well, I would say that it's pretty clear when you look year over year at energy prices that that is a big piece of the inflation package that is really felt by the average person, the average household. Especially when you have something like as salient as as gasoline prices that are, up there on the billboard everywhere you drive, every time you fill up your tank. And that, it's up 11% over the month, but we've already seen it drop since last month, right? So the CPI data is for, last month's average, which is correct. But now, if you look at the prices today, they're already down 7.6% from that month average last year. And there's reason to believe that it can drop a little bit more. Some of the cause of the price increase has been refining capacity. Obviously, the major cause, which has been affecting us for the past half a year or so, is the situation with Russia and Ukraine. And that that's what kind of kicked off this whole energy spike. But what I would say is that as we're looking forward, while we can see a world in which gasoline prices continue to tick down a bit, we're not really going to see them drop down to levels that we saw a year ago unless we either increase supply or decrease demand or some combination of the two. And either of those things are really going to require big investments. And those big investments are going to require some sort of policy certainty around where we're going. And when we're thinking about what should that policy certainty look like, I think at this moment in time, it should be more clear than ever before that as we're thinking about energy prices and energy policy, we should factor in three things all at the same time. One is reducing emissions. We've got to drive towards decarbonization, net zero by 2050. Climate change is a huge economic risk in addition to environmental risk and national security risk. But at the same time, energy affordability is really important to the average person. And if we, do policies that decarbonize but end up with super high energy prices, then people are going to suffer. And lastly, we have to have energy security and reliability. You actually have to have the energy available. If you have rolling blackouts or you're, for instance, Germany shut down nuclear plants and now they're going back to coal, like that takes us in the wrong direction, but that's what they have to do because they need the energy. So as we're thinking about what's next, I encourage all policymakers to think about the long term, decarbonization, energy affordability, energy security and reliability, all in one package, because those are the policies that are going to allow the private sector and individuals to make the long-term investments in their next vehicle, their next fuel source, their next power plant that are going to actually get us from where we are now to a world in which we have affordable energy that is actually decarbonized.
But let's think a little bit about the near term for a minute. Supply doesn't seem to me like we're going to see some near-term increase in supply. Demand, Well, if the world economy slows, we could, and I think that's what accounts for some of the recent decline in oil prices. If we head towards a recession, either here or abroad, demand could fall. So that suggests that what the course of energy prices is going to have a lot to do with how much the economy slows, unless I'm misreading something here. Is that right?
I mean, I think you're right about that. The other things that can affect demand are less near term and more,
right.
I would say, medium term, right?
Right. Dennis, housing. So as I understand it, the official measures of inflation measure housing prices, shelter prices in the U.S. by looking at what people are paying for rent. And we know that rents start to go up when leases come due. And so there seems to be a widespread expectation that the shelter component of the CPI and of what people actually pay is going to continue to go up for a while longer. Is that how you read it or not?
Yeah, that's correct, David. I mean, CPI shelter is the sum of two things, CPI rent, which are rental payments, and CPI ORE, which is called owner's equivalent rent, which is what a homeowner foregoes by not renting the home to someone else. But changes in inflation lag real-time changes in housing costs because the CPI captures current rents paid as opposed to advertised rents for newly vacant units, and leases and mortgages, as you know, typically last, well, at least a rental lease, 12 months or more, and mortgages, 15 [S2] Right. [S1] or 30 years. So if you looked at some of the repeat sales indices put out by private companies like the CoreLogic Home Purchase Index or the Zillow's Observed Rental Index, they've been showing, you know, huge increases in home prices and rents. And so you're absolutely right. It takes time for these housing cost increases to be reflected in the CPI over time. So we should, I think, continue to expect, you know, significant contribution of shelter costs to the CPI going forward.
Let me remind people who are listening that if you want to send a question, you can DM the Brookings account at Brookings Inst, and we'll try and get to as many as possible. Dennis, Zan nicely reminded us that we should think about the long term as well as the short term. In the long term, do you think that we're going to see the kind of much needed increase in the supply of housing, new construction that we seem to need to meet the demand? Housing construction never really recovered from the Great Recession of a decade ago. What do you see looking forward?
Well, I hope so, David. I mean, there are various estimates of the supply shortage. I mean, you hit the point on the nail that there's a supply demand mismatch. There's much more demand than supply. And the estimates vary as to what the supply shortage is. I mean, Mark Zandi, Moody's Analytics, it says it's 1.5 million, Freddie Mac, 3.8 million units. The National Association of Realtors put out a study a year ago saying that we've underbuilt housing of all types by 5.5 million homes, units over the past 20 years. So we really need to embrace policies in the midterm and long term and short term to increase the supply of homes. And at the BPC, we're supporting an expansion of the low-income housing tax credit, enactment of something called the Neighborhood Homes Investment Act, which would encourage private investment in rehabbing and building homes for first-time home ownership in distressed communities. And more broadly, we really need a national reexamination of local zoning and land use policies, which often restrict the types of housing that can be built, limit supply, and drive up housing costs.
Hmm. Justin, there's a question from a listener, or whatever you call people on Twitter, is simply, do you think if what the president does with student loan payments, whether forgiving a bunch of student loans or restarting the requirement that people pay their student loans, do you think that'll have any appreciable effect on inflation?
first I'll do what an academic always does, which is answer a different question.
That's okay. I'm used to that.
On some issues, I think including this, the microeconomics is vastly more important than the macroeconomics. And so what the president does with student loan debt, I think the most important thing is what he, how useful that is relative to what you think the alternative uses of the money were. That's a microeconomic question, involves a lot of values. I certainly have my own view. Were he to forgive student loan debt, that would be a way of thrusting more money in people's pockets. That would be a fiscal expansion. We tend to try and have the government thrust money into people's pockets when we're worried they don't have enough, which is in the middle of a downturn, like during the pandemic. We try to avoid doing that in the middle of an inflationary moment, particularly when supply chains are all messed up. And so, yes, it would probably be inflationary as well.
Wendy, we know that the GDP, the measure of all the output in the U.S. economy, shrank in the first quarter. And there are a number of estimates that suggest that it also shrank in the second quarter. So sometimes people think two quarters of negative GDP growth, that's a recession. Now, we know that's not really the way that people who decide whether we're in a recession look at the world. And this does coincide with a surprisingly strong job market. But I wonder if you, how, what do you think, when you look forward, do you think that we're at risk of slowing so much that we have a recession? Do you think there's a risk that the Fed will react to these inflation numbers and raise interest rates so much that inflation follows? I mean, that a recession follows? How do you think about this?
I think that there are several different possible futures ahead of us. The best possible outcome would be the soft landing. So we
I lost Wendy. Is that my end or her end?
I think we all lost Wendy.
Okay. So, Justin, what do you think? Are we doomed to a recession or can we avoid it?
So we're currently in an economy creating hundreds of thousands of jobs per month with unemployment on the cusp of a 50-year low. That doesn't sound like an economy on the cusp of a recession. I think the point that Wendy was getting to
my phone rang and I went away.
That's okay. Let Justin finish his thought and we'll come back to you, Wendy.
You know, yes, the Fed could make a mistake and create a massive recession. The Fed could also make a mistake and accidentally do an incredibly great job.
That's not exactly a mistake.
You're right. I don't know why people are so fixated on the idea that they know the precise mistake that the Fed is going to make. So, right. You know, for sure, I think a recession is not inevitable. In fact, in the very short run, I think it's not even likely. I'm not making any promises about future years, but for 2022, it seems incredibly unlikely.
Right. So, Wendy, go back to your thought.
Yeah, sorry about that. So, if the economy slows, as I expect it will, and that brings down inflation with it, then I think we are, you know, it's entirely possible that we will have a soft landing. And to be clear, when I say slow, that might mean that we have a mild recession. I don't think individuals are going to experience a mild recession very much, you know, very differently than just weak positive growth. So, but the fear, the outcome, which would be far more problematic, is if the economy slows and inflation doesn't come down. Because what that means is that the Fed's got a problem on its hand with either inflation expectations being too high or a series of really bad supply shocks coming over and over that are pushing prices up ever higher, which is essentially saying our economy has less ability to grow. And in both circumstances, the Fed's going to probably react by slowing the economy much more dramatically. And that's the pain that we're trying to avoid. But a mild slowdown that we're on track for, and you know, this will all be, I think, a grand success if we can get a soft landing.
Right. So just to be clear, what I just want to make sure people don't misinterpret what you said. It's not that a recession is a good thing. It's just that if we have a mild recession, which means the economy contracts a little bit, that means that maybe not a lot of people suffer, and it will help us avoid a much bigger problem down the road if the Fed really has to slam on the brakes because inflation is persistent. Fair?
Well, so I think the pain is going to come even with a mild recession, and that everyone's not going to experience it equally.
Right.
So our goods sector is likely going to contract. And that's going to be painful for, you know, firms in the goods sector and people working in the goods sector. But the context to put that in is that our goods sector ballooned in the past year and a half or so. And so it, I don't know that, you know, I mean, it's on track to contract because our economy is just out of whack. Hmm. And so I think the economy needs to slow because it's trying to do more than it can do, and so a couple of quarters of slowing, or you know, three quarters of slowing will help our economy like take a breath after the craziness of, you know, the past year and a half.
So one of the listeners asks, do we see any further rate increases from the Federal Reserve? And the answer to that is yes.
Yes.
They're almost certain to raise rates at least 0.75 percentage point at their next meeting. And they've signaled that they're going to keep raising rates until they are convinced that inflation is slowing and then rates are more in line with a very strong job market. But Justin, the questioner goes on to ask, what implications do rising rates in the U.S. have for emerging economies outside the United States? Can you take that?
I can take it, probably not very well.
Yeah, I could do that too. That's why I gave it to you.
Thanks, man. it's always good to have someone who wants to make you, you know. Let me just start with one point, which is what really matters for the economy is real interest rates adjusted for inflation. And so real interest rates only rise when the Fed raises its nominal rate by more than inflation has risen. And as aggressive as the Fed's rate rising campaign has been, it's not actually totally obvious that it has yet caught up to what's happened to inflation. So it's not totally obvious yet that it has raised rates, although it will obviously seek to do so in the future. You know, this will be yet another drag on the global economy, and include if the Fed succeeds at what it's trying to do, it's trying to take the heat out of demand. That will affect demand not just in the US but around the world. And so, to the extent that there's an effect, it will be to slow emerging economies. But there is so much going on around the world right now. There are certain points where we all sit around staring at the Fed saying, the Fed really matters for emerging economies, but you know, the virus really matters for emerging economies. China's slowdown really matters for emerging economies, and the invasion of Ukraine really matters for emerging economies. So the Fed is relevant, but it may not be central.
Right, but one thing that we do know now is that, in part because interest rates in the U.S. are rising faster than in other countries, the value of the U.S. dollar has gone up, and that has two effects on emerging markets. One, those emerging markets that have borrowed in dollars feel the pain because they have to have more of their local currency to pay their dollar debts. And it also tends, if history is a teacher, to have capital leave emerging markets where they went when rates were low here and they might come out. So for some countries, this could be pretty severe. And we've seen already, like in Sri Lanka, it's a basket case for this and other reasons. Before we end, I wanted to ask Dennis and Zan if they have any thoughts either on their areas of specialty or on the overall inflation picture. Zan, do you want to start? What do we miss on energy, and what do you think about inflation? Are you for it or against it?
that's a great question. You know, obviously, I think that the thing that people are really focused on right now is, you know, what it means to them. And, you know, so for some people, that's gas prices that matter. For some people, it's natural gas prices that matter. You know, we've seen actually an interesting volatility in natural gas prices, you know, we've got the exports to Europe, but those were curtailed to a significant extent because of the Freeport LNG accident, which lowered natural gas prices here in the U.S. But now they're heading back up again. A lot of people are using natural gas for home heating. And in Europe, their supplies, they're using so much this summer that they're getting worried about winter. And if you've taken a flight recently, like I took a last minute flight this past weekend, like airplane fares are up a bunch because of jet fuel. So, you know, as we're thinking about energy prices, you know, one thing to remember is that, you know, that you can lump them all together, but in some ways they're a bit discrete on depending on what you use. Like if you're using natural gas in your house, or if you're driving a car versus if you have an electric car, all in all, I'll just want to just get back to my original point is that the inflation right now and the suffering people are going through because of energy prices right now should make us focus crystal clear on the long-term investments of the future that have to involve both energy affordability, reliability, and decarbonization.
And yeah, airline fares is a good point. I don't think it's only energy prices. Obviously, they cut capacity during the pandemic, and every plane is crowded, and they're having trouble getting staff. But just to put some numbers behind it, in over the last 12 months, airfares, according to the CPI, have risen 34%. But they were actually down on a seasonally adjusted basis 1.8%. in June, after 2 months of double-digit increases. And Dennis, any final words of thought on the housing scene?
Well, we've seen some cooling of the home purchase market, the red-hot home purchase market. But when the Fed raises its rates, that will obviously translate into higher mortgage rates. And despite a cooling in the housing market, home purchase market, probably more and more would-be homeowners will be shut out of the home purchase market. And therefore, you're probably going to see continued strength of the rental market and really strong demand for rental housing. So solving the supply shortage problem on both the for rent and for sale side is going to take some time. But we really need to have a focus as a nation on building more homes.
Yeah, that's a good point about mortgage rates. The Fed has raised rates some, but mortgage rates have gone up quite a bit. It's just another way that financial markets amplify and carry the effect of monetary policy, which is part of the way this all works. So I want to thank Wendy and Justin and Dennis and Zan for joining us today. And we'll do this again maybe next month. Maybe we'll have better news and we can say that inflation has peaked. I certainly hope so.